This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Among the televised Winter Olympic attractions available today and tonight from Italy are the luge, women's ice hockey featuring teams from the USA, Switzerland, Finland, and Germany, among others, the biathlon, freestyle skiing, alpine skiing. Gee, how are they going to have anything left for the remaining 15 days of these games? Joining me now on the line from Torino to answer that question, as well as various others, is the Boston Globe's John Powers, who is, as usual, covering the Olympics. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Buongiorno, Bill. Oh, well, everything is here. These games did actually begin.
You were on hand in Stadio Olimpico yesterday for the opening ceremonies. Each host country tries to outdo the last, of course, highlighting local history and culture. So what exactly was up with the two-foot-high red flames shooting out of the helmets of the inline skaters?
They just kept coming. The flaming heads were one of the highlights of the games. In addition to the big crinolines, and Yoko Ono showed up, and Susan Sarandon, Luciano Pavarotti. It was basically 100 years of Italian culture and anybody else that they could throw into the mix.
Dancers with white bubbles stuck to their heads were said to represent snow, which is good because all of Torino's snow recently melted. But other than Mother Nature's lack of cooperation, is the host city pretty much prepared for the games?
They seem to be, but we haven't really snow in the last week downtown, and nothing is really predicted for a while. That's been part of the problem here. It's hard to get the Olympic spirit in this town. In the mountains, it'll be different, but I think that that was always the big problem here. The motto is passion lives here, but it's always going to be passion lives here in Turin. They're not known to be the most passionate people here, and I think what they're trying to do is reawaken some excitement.
2 hours after the opening ceremonies were complete, the Torino 2006 website was still offering tickets to the event, and it was over. Should organizers be worried about filling seats?
Well, I think they are close to what they thought they would sell. They were hoping to sell about 800,000 out of the 1 million, and they're pretty close to that. What I think will happen is once Italians start winning medals, the place will get more excited. This thing has been coming so long, and it has been delayed with building delays so long that no one really realized that it was finally going to be here. And I think the Italians are known for doing things at the last minute. And the ticket sales certainly have picked up greatly in the last week. But once they actually see sports being, you know, happening on TV, I think you'll see more of an emotional response here.
NBC, of course, time-delayed the opening ceremonies to primetime for U.S. viewers. Between NBC and its cable partners, the network will offer 416 hours of Olympic programming for an average of 24 and a half hours a day. Do you have any advice, John, on how anybody can see it all?
I don't think so. You know, one of the problems here is you can't eat the entire smorgasbord. And people always complained that you weren't getting enough stuff, and now you will get everything. There will be every rock of every curling match will be shown, every women's hockey team. But I think what has been happening here now is there is so much media, so much exposure to these games, that they're inescapable now for 17 days.
2 days before the start of competition, eight cross-country skiers were suspended for high hemoglobin levels. High hemoglobin levels can be a result of illegal doping practices, but also of a recent plane trip or, as I understand it, a result of nothing at all. They can just happen. What's going on here?
Well, this is a test, basically, that they were using on the cyclists during the pre-Olympic year in Athens. It's done supposedly for health reasons, but it also gets to be a heads up for someone who might be using EPO, which is a banned blood booster. If it's just, you know, an abnormally high carb because of dehydration, because of elevation, it goes away. But they'll be watching these skiers in another 5 days, and if their counts are still up, they may be banned then.
Mm. Over the past few years, the Winter Olympics have offered some interesting doping stories, most notably Canadian snowboarder Ross Rebliati, who almost lost his gold medal due to a positive test for, quote, secondhand marijuana smoke. But have you ever before heard of an athlete banned from the Olympics because he refused to go bald gracefully?
No, I mean, this is a black day for the hair club for men. Had said, you know, if this is God's way of making me know he wants me to be bald, I get the message. But It is, again, I think, a very confusing thing to a lot of people that something you could use to grow hair would, in fact, be a banned drug, but it has been used as a masking agent for steroids in the past. What you're going to see here, as you did in Athens, by the way, is much more aggressive doping. There'll be 70% more tests than there were in Salt Lake City. And like Athens 2 years ago, they can test you in your home country before you come here and after you leave. As long as that candle is lit in the Olympic Stadium, you can be tested.
John, my favorite unlikely hero of these games thus far is Rebel Teklemariam, an Ethiopian who's trying to capitalize on his countrymen's success in long-distance running by trying for a medal in cross-country skiing. Do you have a favorite kind of Eddie the Eagle type who's going to bubble up for us in these Winter Olympics?
He may be the best one. As a matter of fact, what we're hoping for is the African Nordic Championships to happen here. There is one Kenyan also, so I think Kenya-Ethiopia could be the story of these Nordic games here.
We're going to have to wait for next week for some of the most spectacular events of these games, but I know that what I'm most looking forward to in the meantime, and I've already told Gary I'm not coming to work Tuesday morning because that's when we get the U.S.-New Zealand men's curling match.
That's right. Everyone here in the Piedmont area is spellbound by the idea of that.
All right, John, all kidding aside, what are you looking forward to in the coming week?
Well, I'll be doing the figure skating and the short track speed skating. So what mostly I'm looking forward to is banging elbows with the Korean journalists inside of the tiny mix zone that they have here. What normally happens at these games, you're either a snow person or an ice person. And I will be an ice person down here. But what I would love to do is go out into the half pipe and see the flying tomato, Sean White, who's the great medal hope here. He's the person who is captivating certainly everybody under 20 in Italy. Everybody knows him. This is the only event we're going from the X Games to the Olympic Games is a step down.
John Powers covers all things Olympic for the Boston Globe. John, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
While they're in Italy, U.S. Olympians and their families will be welcomed at the Hometown Hopefuls Center, sponsored by Bank of America. There they will find free lunches, TVs tuned to the games, and computers with which they can email home. Beyond providing the facility, Bank of America says it's making it possible for families without Olympic-sized bank accounts to attend the games. Patty Gorgoni, whose daughter Michelle is on the U.S. snowboarding team, did find her accommodations through Bank of America, but she thinks the corporation's claim may be exaggerated.
I'm probably in a 2-star hotel and I'm paying almost $1,000 a night. It's the Olympics. This is what they do. And I would say that, you know, they're giving, you know, maybe like 10% discounts on lodging, which is a big amount considering the price of them. But if you can afford the $5,000 or $6,000 that a week in a hotel is going to cost, you know, saving, you know, a few hundred dollars, I don't think would make or break.
That qualification notwithstanding, Michelle Gorgoni says she's happy to do what she can as a spokesperson for Bank of America.
They just want me to put out the name and can't usually shut up, so now I just get to talk and at least I have something to talk about.
Supporting particular athletes, sometimes in lieu of becoming an official sponsor of the games, is not a new strategy, though it has become more popular over the past few Olympiads. According to John Bevilacqua, who was the vice president of communications at the 1984 Olympics and now heads a company called Creative Marketing Strategies, economics has driven that movement.
Paying for sponsorship is only the ticket to the dance. You still got to rent a tuxedo and buy a corsage and rent a limo. The fact is that for many years, there was not a lot of creativity. Corporations paid the money to be an Olympic sponsor, and then they made some commercials and they entertained their customers at the games. But as the cost of sponsorship has gone up in the last 15, 20 years, and certainly since the 1984 Olympics, corporations have had to become more creative and find better ways to promote their association with the Olympic brand.
John Bevilacqua feels that the professionalization of the games has not changed the positive attitude most people have toward Olympic hopefuls, but sponsoring a particular athlete can also be dangerous from a public relations standpoint. John Bevilacqua encourages companies to support the games and the athletes, but feels they ought to understand that the generation of goodwill is not a sure thing.
Corporations who associate with athletes do take some risk. It doesn't matter what sport you're talking about. They all have their risks. And I'm not going to name names, but I have seen Olympic athletes with high name recognition who have showed up for speaking engagements for which they were paid very handsome fees, who were so drunk they couldn't talk.
Among the most high-profile Olympic athletes directly benefiting from an association with a corporation is controversial ski champion Bodie Miller. Miller is the director of skiing at the Bretton Woods Resort in New Hampshire.
Bodie was instrumental in designing a new ski run that just opened last year called Bodie's Run.
Martha Wilson is the resort public relations manager at Bretton Woods.
We also have some kids programs. We have one that's actually his namesake, Team Bodie, where we teach young people how to race. And so that's a program that runs throughout the winter, and he was instrumental in designing the curriculum for that as well.
Though competing around the world prevents the Bretton Woods director of skiing from actually directing much of the skiing there, Bodie Miller hits the slopes with patrons when he can. He plays golf with them in the summer, too. And according to Martha Wilson, there's no reason to think that will change when Bodie's no longer in the headlines.
We're looking forward to that time when he retires and makes Bretton Woods his home. You know, right now we're actually building a home for him on a ridge facing the ski area. And we anticipate that once he's retired from racing, he's going to be here more frequently and really can spend more time on developing children's programs or helping us with trail design and really becoming part of the community.
It's difficult to measure the extent to which a bank or a resort benefits from associations with Olympic athletes, though apparently Bank of America will give measurement a try. Kathy Besant, the bank's vice president in charge of global marketing, recently acknowledged that she and her team will look for tangible outcomes, that is, increases in customers, deposits, and loans, resulting from their Hometown Hopefuls program. It's 19 minutes past the... I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, making the jump from club sport to varsity in a college hockey hotbed. But first, the unfolding investigation of an alleged New Jersey gambling ring has National Hockey League observers wondering how many players, coaches, and front office personnel were involved and how deeply, and whether the reputations of the league and the man almost universally considered to be the greatest hockey player of all time will fare. Here to provide insight on that matter is ESPN's Scott Burnside. Scott, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back.
On Tuesday, it was learned that Phoenix Coyotes assistant coach and former NHL player Rick Tocchet will be arraigned on charges of money laundering, conspiracy, and promoting gambling. According to New Jersey authorities, between December 29th and February 5th, bettors placed $1.7 million in wagers with a ring allegedly run by Tocchet, a New Jersey state trooper, and one other man. Is there enough evidence to support the state's case, do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm not privy to exactly what all of the cards that the New Jersey authorities hold, but given the way they came out with this information, and I haven't heard many people other than Mr. Tocchet's defense lawyer come out and say there's absolutely no way Rick Tocchet did this, it really has been an issue of, no, I wasn't involved, or I didn't know what was going on. And I think the real issue now is, who are these other people that were making the bets, and what exactly were they doing, what exactly was their involvement, what kind of information exactly were they passing along to these people, some of whom are known members or associates of crime families? And I think that's the other shoe that has yet to drop.
Assuming that these allegations are true, how could Rick Tocchet, a former player who has heard all the warnings about gambling for years, how could he have thought that he could get away with financing a gambling ring?
Well, having had my calls to Rick's cell phone not returned this week, I can't offer you any insight into his thought process on in terms of what he was doing and whether he thought he could get away with it. The question is a good one, and I think it extends to whether it's Janet Jones, Wayne Gretzky's wife, who has been named by a number of sources, frankly, including Wayne, at least tacitly, as having gambled with this syndicate. Why? If you want to gamble, you can go to Las Vegas. Phoenix isn't that far away. You can gamble legally on off-site centers using your internet. You don't have to leave the comfort of your palatial home on the West Coast. You can do all of these things without betting with an illegal gambling ring. And I think probably what it comes down to is that these are friends. This is a group of friends, at least in terms of the hockey connection. And I think they felt there was probably nothing wrong in doing it because of the friendship element.
You mentioned Wayne Gretzky and his wife, Janet Jones. That whole thing has developed in a very murky sort of way. First, Gretzky said his wife hadn't been involved. Then, as you say, he tacitly seemed to suggest that she had been involved. Where does all that stand?
This is why this story has the legs that it does, because, I mean, this is hockey's royal couple. I mean, there is, you know, he's not just the head coach of the Phoenix Coyotes. He's not just the greatest player of all time. He's a part owner of an NHL franchise and the executive director of the Canadian Olympic team. The fact that the information has sort of been contradictory in terms of what Wayne Gretzky has said from the beginning has added a layer of doubt, which I think is driving this story forward. I mean, a lot of this is about the optics for the NHL now. There is no indication that anyone bet on NHL games as of yet. That is the great fear, of course, for the league. And there is no indication that Wayne Gretzky ever placed any bets with this syndicate. I think it's, you know, what we're waiting for now, and at some point Janet Jones will have to come forward. She made a statement earlier that supported Wayne's comments that he never bet. But let's hear a little bit more about what Janet's involvement was.
New Jersey officials have said that Jones bet $500,000, although her spokesman has said, quote, there is no allegation that Janet has violated any law. I'm not sure quite how to reconcile those two statements. Betting $500,000 with a betting ring doesn't violate the law?
Apparently not technically. It's technically not illegal to place a bet with such an organization. Where the legal issues come in is when you win that bet. I'm sure a lot of this looks like much ado about nothing. And frankly, if it all comes down to a group of friends who placed large sums of money on football or basketball games, I think there is a potential for this to go away quite painlessly in terms of the National Hockey League. Again, the whole issue, though, is when you talk about organized crime and you talk about the potential for players or coaches to trade off information to either reduce debts or to whatever the case may be with people whose influence extends beyond the sporting world, and we talk about that sort of criminal behavior, that is the great unknown about where this investigation may end up.
Scott, do you have any sense about how much time it will take for this investigation to begin to develop information about underworld connections, if there are any?
Well, I think that, I mean, if I understand the undercover element of this investigation is that those links have been made quite clearly. I think what's unknown is exactly what these underworld figures were doing. Were they simply placing bets in the same fashion that Janet Jones is alleged to have placed bets, or were they controlling the operation in more of a partnership with Rick Tockett and his other partner, the former New Jersey State Trooper? So those things, I think those are the elements that aren't clear yet in terms of this investigation. And in terms of going forward, I think it's really about ferreting out who these people were who were betting and exactly what they were doing, how they got involved, what they understood to be the nature of this betting situation. And, one would hope that these people will come forward, make themselves known to the investigators, make themselves known to the National Hockey League. Once those people make themselves known, this thing could move very quickly and, in fact, could go away very quickly. But, whether all these people are stand-up enough to come out and make themselves known in a timely fashion is yet to be seen.
There's been a lot of hand-wringing along the lines of this couldn't have come at a worse time for the National Hockey League, which is still trying to climb out of the hole it dug for itself by losing a whole season. Is that true, or is the NHL down so low that nothing could kick it lower?
No, I think those sentiments are exactly accurate. For a league that looked to have been driving itself into a hole from which it might never return, The NHL has come back with astounding success. They've set attendance records every month since the start of the season. And then next week, you have the start of the men's hockey tournament at the Olympics. Barring some injuries, you've got, you know, the best players in the world promising to come together in, I think, probably the most exciting best-on-best hockey tournament ever. And then you've got the Sopranos intruding on the hockey picture, and everything now is tainted by that. And I head to Turin in a matter of a day or so, and I know this story will continue to dominate the hockey story in Turin, and it will continue to dominate the story once that tournament is over. It's going to happen, and until there's a resolution one way or the other about who these people are and what happened, that will be the case through the rest of the season.
Scott Burnside covers the NHL for ESPN, and he joins us from time to time on Only a Game. Scott, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Last week, in her office at the Bright Center, Harvard University's hockey rink, women's varsity coach Katie Stone speculated about her team's upcoming game against Boston University. The last two times Harvard played BU in the Women's Beanpot Tournament, a 28-year-old February tradition that pits the women's teams from Harvard, BU, Boston College, and Northeastern University against each other, Harvard prevailed by an aggregate score of 13-0. Over their previous 17 meetings, Harvard has won 82-0. I asked Coach Stone if drawing BU in the opening round of the Beanpot meant a free trip to the finals.
Not true this year. And if anyone looks past BU, then I know that we're playing them first, and I won't be sure that our program will not be looking past BU, because they've been playing with a lot of heart and desire, and so anything can happen, and you never want to look past someone who's very hungry trying to scratch their way to the top.
Before the current season, the BU women's team, which I visited at practice last week, couldn't imagine the top, let alone scratch their way toward it. Though Boston University has long been home to an accomplished men's team, until this season, women's ice hockey was not a varsity sport at BU. As a club team, the BU aggregation lacked scholarships, a recruiting budget, and adequate ice time, as well as various other amenities.
Basically, like, all our outdoor equipment, like, you know, our pants and our socks, you know, were basically guy leftovers.
Amy Lay is one of three current BU varsity players who played on the club team.
The average height of our team was probably about 5'2", so the pants were falling off most of the girls. We got the socks when the men, you know, said that these socks were too bad, you know, too many holes in them. That's when they gave them to us.
Lay, who worked with a strength and conditioning coach to enhance her chances of making the jump from club to varsity, says this season has been a different story.
Oh, definitely. It feels like the whole time we're getting all our equipment, I used to come in here and just be like, man, this is Christmas. Brand new stuff and these plastic bags, you know. First time you go out there, you just feel like a whole new person. You're like, I've never had equipment this nice before. This is great.
According to Amy Lay, one of the other differences between playing for a club team and playing for the varsity is that club team players figure out their academic schedules first and then see if they have time to play some hockey. Varsity players get their practice schedules, then try to sign up for classes that won't conflict with their athletic obligations. Kirsten Matthews, who coached the club team at BU and is now an assistant coach for the varsity, agrees that playing for a varsity team involves a commitment lots of young athletes can't or don't want to make.
My captain last year had a full-time job to support herself to go to BU. So they came here to play club hockey as something extra to do, maybe an extra way to meet friends or an extra way to exercise. Not everybody was here because they wanted to be the best hockey player that they could be. So they came here for different reasons.
The 18 freshmen, three club team veterans, and three transfers on the current BU squad are no doubt there for hockey. Several of the freshmen have said they were particularly attracted to the opportunity to help create a program, and of course by the chance to compete as freshmen rather than sit on the bench watching the upperclassmen play. Aaron Seaman, a freshman from Minnesota, is one of the youngsters who immediately fit into the hard-working lunch pail-type team Coach Brian DeRocher has been building. In fact, Seaman leads the BU team in penalty minutes. In a game where checking is technically illegal, I wondered how she was piling up those minutes.
Speechless. Well, I don't know. I'm aggressive. I'm a little stronger than some of the people. I need to learn how to keep my elbows down when I go in the boards. I don't know. I've had two penalties for hitting the goalie, for running into the goalie when the puck, they get, we both meet the puck at the same time and I hit her. It's happened twice, so I got 10 minutes for those.
That aggressiveness has no doubt pleased Coach DeRocher, though the minutes in the box have not. At practice last week, he made a point of warning his players against dumb penalties. Until this season, DeRocher, who was the goalie for BU's national championship team in 1977-78, served as an assistant coach in the men's hockey program, where he had developed a reputation as a terrific recruiter. The men's team draws thousands of fans to its games and has won four national championships. I asked Coach DeRocher if he liked being the head coach for the women more than he'd enjoyed assisting longtime men's head coach Jack Parker.
There's parts that you miss of the men's side, you know, the euphoria of all the people in the building, you know, the excitement that goes on. But I think it's paralleled on the women's side. You know, they have as much passion, as much desire, as much interest in playing the game. And I think being a head coach makes it that much more fun. You're ultimately running the show, and in this case, you're doing more than running the show. You're building the show, I guess, because we haven't had a varsity team. So it clearly is a pretty easy thing to answer at this point.
The show is up and running more quickly than most people thought it would be, Brian DeRocher included. The coach admits that he thought the first-year varsity might win only four or five games, but coming into Tuesday night's first-round beanpot game against Harvard, BU had won 10 and tied four more while losing 13. The team's most surprising win came against sometime national power Providence, but BU also beat Northeastern once and tied Brown in Boston College. But how would a team that's 75% freshman handle itself in the 28th beanpot? Very well, as it turned out. After falling behind 1-0 in the first period, the BU team played Harvard even until only 8 minutes remained in the game. Then they scored. By that point, BU goalie Elise Wilcox, another freshman from Michigan, had made 35 saves. Her opposite number in the Harvard goal, Allie Bowe, had only had to make about a third that many. The game went into overtime where, unhappily for BU, the Harvard players seemed to suddenly recall that their team had won the previous 7 beanpot trophies and needed a win Tuesday night to have a shot at an 8th. Just 46 seconds into the overtime, Harvard solved the riddle that Wilcox had been for a 2-1 win. BU would have to be content with a rematch against Northeastern in next Tuesday night's consolation round game, after which Harvard and Boston College will play for the title. But even as his players were wearily hauling their equipment bags out to the bus, BU coach DeRocher was talking about what he and they should take from the loss.
The positives are every kid that was wearing that uniform that found a way to make this thing more exciting than most people figured it would, to prove again that they have tremendous heart and a tremendous desire to be successful out there. And they just plain make my job and our staff's job fun because they give it everything they can every night. And, you know, you get a couple of saves and you get all the block shots that they had. It's a tribute to them, and it sure makes it enjoyable for what we're doing. And, you know, long term, hope we build to find a way to just get over that hurdle.
Based on Tuesday night's game and on the fact that goalie Elise Wilcox has 3 more years to play, the BU women may get over that hurdle sooner rather than later.
But do you think it's gonna last, or will it be just like the past? When they lose, they're not rebuilding. I'm tired of that word. Let's win. Just win. Let's win. I'm tired of the way.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's just like the past. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, plucking medals out of the air in Sestri Air. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
You've written about Wayne Gretzky. You've spent time in his hometown, talked with his relatives and with Gretzky himself. Gretzky insists that he placed no wagers with an alleged New Jersey gambling ring in which his assistant coach has been implicated. Even if that is the case, does Gretzky come out of this as hockey's most respected and revered figure?
Probably not. First of all, the whole story is an enormous blow to a sport that really doesn't need one at this point. It's certainly one thing hockey doesn't need right now is a gambling scandal. For the problem Gretzky has, of course, is that he has turned up on a wiretap talking to Rick Tocchet about whether or not they could keep Wayne's wife, Janet Jones, name out of the papers in regards to this thing. Good luck there, by the way. No, I think what has heretofore been an extraordinarily untarnished image is picking up a little green glop on its edges.
As you mentioned, Janet Jones, Wayne Gretzky's wife, has been implicated in this betting operation. She is said to have bet $500,000 on various games recently. Mr. Gretzky has maintained that this is simply not a story about him. Is he right?
Well, I so far there's no evidence indicating that beyond supposition and surmise. The argument that, you know, his wife didn't know a lot about sports and therefore couldn't bet on them is belied by anybody who's walked through the sports book at Caesars at any time. The one thing that people who take bets for a living count on is people who don't know anything betting. and once they have a sucker like apparently Janet Jones was on the line, it's very unlikely that they let her go anytime soon.
What does the NHL do? As you mentioned, a scandal upon a lost season is not exactly what it needs. What do they do
now?
Well,
if Gary Bettman were alive, this would kill him. I swear. I mean, this would probably be the last straw. I don't know. And coming up, Wayne Gretzky's coaching Team Canada in the Olympics, and who knows what the IOC people will do.
Yeah, also, you wonder if the Canadian players over there in Italy for the Olympics have got one eye on the news back home and are wondering which names bubble up next.
Well, see, I think that's another problem. Were you to say, oh, I don't know, gamble on the Olympic hockey tournament, you would certainly have to, you know, take that into consideration before laying any lira down on the Canadian team.
Now that the opening ceremonies at the Olympics have closed, which Olympic events are you most looking forward to watching?
Well, always short track speed skating, because as you know, I am Mr. NASCAR. And the closest thing we have in human-to-human competition to NASCAR is short track speed skating.
Mm-hmm.
I am enormously disappointed that the Australian who won because everybody fell down will not be returning to defend his richly earned gold medal this time. But I'm sure that some unexpected thing that we've never seen in any sporting event anywhere will happen during short track speed skating.
Charlie, you maintain solemnly each year that the Super Bowl is good. And you attended last weekend's game. Well, was it?
The Super Bowl is good. This Super Bowl sucked. Outside of the city of Detroit.
Not mincing any words,
outside of the city of Detroit, which did a great G-R-E-A-T job on this, the events surrounding this game, this was the worst championship-level sporting event I have ever seen, ever. It was badly played. There was no suspense. The officiating was next to abysmal, which I guess is probably in New Jersey somewhere. There was nothing redeemable about the 40 minutes of football that got played in Ford Field. I'm sort of happy for Bill Cowher. He's a football lifer. He's dedicated his life to a franchise that doesn't have a barrel full of money and has managed to build team after team that competed for a championship. I'm glad he got that. As far as the actual game of football played in Detroit, it was a complete waste of time and pixel space on television.
The week's best basketball story stars Dick Bavetta, who officiated his 2,135th consecutive game on Wednesday night. Almost needless to say, that's a record. Preserving that streak during which he has never missed a game can't have been easy.
Well, the secret, he says, is wearing five pairs of socks. He takes care of his feet.
Something to remember.
I mean, Nick jogs 8 miles every morning, spends 3.5 hours working out every day in the summer. He mountain bikes. He rows a boat on Lake George.
And how old is he?
He is 66 years old. Mm. He takes a one-day vacation every year, during which he walks away and has himself a single ice cream cone.
Less fortunate than Dick Bavetta was Deb Ramurti of Northwestern College in Des Moines, Charlie. She had made 133 free throws in a row, which is the record in organized basketball of any type, and she missed one on Wednesday night. Do you suppose the people waving the big foam fingers behind the baseline that night feel really bad?
Probably not, but, I mean, after all, her team won 95-66 over Dakota Wesleyan, so Deb can't be that unhappy. Her 133 surpassed a boys' high school mark set by a kid from New Orleans, De La Salle, named Daryl Moreau, is 126. The NCAA record is only 69 in a row. The NBA is only 94. Neither the highest level of college basketball nor the highest level of professional basketball has found anybody's been able to get into triple digits yet.
Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban announced this week that he owns Lakers coach Phil Jackson. What has got this particular billionaire feuding with this particular multimillionaire?
Oh, Phil's making noise that the referees are intimidated by Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban, who was cute for about 11 seconds 5 years ago and has now become a blight, has started mouthing off on every level of the media, about every level of the media, and now he says he's in Phil Jackson's head. His Dallas Mavericks, of course, have ended the first half of the season on a remarkable run. They've won 13 in a row going into the weekend's games, and they've held the last 9 or 10 opponents to under 100 points. Right now, they're playing like the best team in the league.
Pauline, where you going to? Pauline, where you going to?
Molina, where you going to? Can you answer that musical question, Charlie?
He's going to Toronto for $5 million for 1 year. The gold glove catcher who spent his first 8 years with the Angels of whatever, by whatever, where forever, has decided, I think, to go to a team with a simpler masthead. And we'll be playing in Toronto this year.
Yeah, and the Jays have been stockpiling talent during this offseason. Is it enough talent so that they'll vie for the American League pennant with the Red Sox and the Yankees?
I think if the Red Sox pitching doesn't straighten out, they'll make a three-way race of it. They have A.J. Burnett, B.J. Ryan, Troy Glossu, if he stays healthy, is a great pickup, and now Benji Molina and Jason Phillips to catch. They are making one big run at it this year.
And finally, Charlie, Al Michaels has been traded from NBC to ESPN in a complicated deal that involves, among other things, the rights to future Ryder Cup golf matches, Olympic highlights, and Oswald the Rabbit. Oswald the Rabbit?
Well, I guess we'll have to see what Jack Ruby the Rabbit says about this now. Oswald the Rabbit was returned by NBC to the Walt Disney Company. Now, there's a lot of backstory here that has absolutely nothing to do with Al Michaels. In 1927, Walt Disney produced a series of cartoons starring Oswald the Rabbit. But Universal distributed the series. Oh, Universal wound up owning the rights to the character of Oswald the Rabbit. Undaunted, Disney responded by inventing a character called Mickey Mouse.
Charlie
and now
Pierce.
You know the rest.
Charlie Pierce, nothing Mickey Mouse about him, whom we would not trade for Bugs Bunny or even Yosemite Sam, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can listen at your leisure to programs past and present on our website, onlyagame.org. Some people take up competitive sports to reverse, or at least delay, the effects of aging. As commentator Susan Sabin learned, sometimes that decision can lead to unexpected perspective.
I decided to enter the first race of my life at age 66. Why not take the leap from bike touring to bike racing? Push myself a bit. On a whim, I Googled senior games. Bingo, the state races were coming up in 2 months. The distance between idea and done deal suddenly seemed perilously short. I hedged. On the one hand, I started an e-correspondence with a coach, bought a heart rate monitor, and began following his instructions. On the other, I told myself I'd commit after I timed my speed on the official race course. Meanwhile, I tossed the idea around to friends. The more people I entrusted with it, the more I felt trapped by my own big mouth. My training began with half-mile timed sprints. On my first try, I got so nervous, I erased the miles per hour on my bike computer and pushed the wrong buttons on the heart rate monitor. I ended up exhausted and with no readings. As I piled on the hours, I became increasingly miserable. I was concentrating on asphalt, memorizing potholes, and fixating on instruments. I decided to quit. On a visit to my sister in the Berkshires, I telephoned my coach. "Everyone hits these spots," he said. "It's normal." I pulled my bike out of my sister's garage and, for the first time since I'd started training, relaxed enough to see the countryside. Soon I learned to draft, biking full speed, 1 foot behind another cyclist. I upped my cadence, churning my legs like a hamster's on a water wheel. I studied tapes of the Tour de France, enlisted friends to act as my rabbit. I even began to see results. My resting heart rate went down 10 beats, my peak rate up 10. I was biking faster, feeling good. Then the unexpected happened. My sister turned from good health to near death in 2 hours. I raced to her bedside in a hospital ICU. 3 weeks later, she was still there. The bike race came and went. It was a disappointment, but not a big one. As any senior should know, a journey is as important as a destination.
Susan Sabin spends her time cycling, writing, and grandparenting. Freestyle skiing gets underway today with the Moguls competition in Val di Susa, approximately 50 miles from Torino. Next week, freestyler Ryan Saint-Ange could earn a medal in the aerial competition. Saint-Ange claims he's clumsy on land, but he finished sixth at the 2005 World Championships and plans to show the world what he can do in the air at his first Olympic Games. Nancy Greenlease of member station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado, reports.
With a name like Ryan Saint-Ange, he should be a soap opera star. He's also got the looks, golden blonde hair, arresting blue eyes, and skin that glows from hours on the mountain. And he admits there's plenty of drama in his life and his teammates.
I've noticed that every single person that does aerials is crazier than anybody else I've met. My teammates are whacked out of their minds, and they would think I'm weird, so I guess I'm in trouble.
The 22-year-old isn't acting. A rational human probably wouldn't choose to perform aerial moves. A freestyle aerial skier must go about 35 miles per hour into a ramp and then flip and twist over and over in the air before landing on 2 feet, hopefully. Ryan Saint-Ange, however, says he was born to fly.
I fell when I was very young. I fell and I chipped my tooth and I bloodied up my nose, and I happened to just be walking down the sidewalk when I did it. So from then on, I guess I figured I was safer in the air than on the ground.
At the age of 6, he made his first jump on snow when he unexpectedly went over a bump, became airborne, and landed on his head. He'd found his sport and began capturing some attention.
I think every girl had a crush on Ryan at 8 years old, but I grew out of that because he came more like my brother.
That's aerial skier Kate Reed, who grew up competing with Saint-Ange.
We're always the ones that got left behind from the parties, though, at the events like all the older kids went to, and tried to convince our parents that, like, I'm like, well, Ryan's going, and Ryan tells Dad, well, Kate's going, and they're both like, right, there's a little conspiracy going on here.
The childhood friends, along with U.S. Olympic aerialist Emily Cook, share a house in Park City, Utah, part of the year. It's crowded with motorcycles and dirt bikes, ski equipment, and uniforms. The competitive spirit doesn't rest here, as proven during the great cookie dough fight of 2005. It's a Three's Company-style house with Saint-Ange as Jack Tripper, a role he doesn't mind.
I would like to think I'm clean, but I'm not. I would like to think I'm good at cooking, but I'm not. So I would like to think I'm the man of the house, but I'm not. So I just try as hard as I can to not be one of the women.
Reed accepts the quirky Saint-Ange just the way he is. She admires his tenacity. During practice, she says he's able to cram in a high number of jumps and make nearly everyone productive. And while he may star in an extreme sport, Reed says his behavior isn't.
He's just very original and genuine, never wondering if he's fake. He knows where he stands with everyone and everything.
Some in-house coaching undoubtedly shaped Saint-Ange. His father was a U.S. ski coach, his mother coached on the regional level, and his brother is a former elite freestyle skier. The family used to travel the country in an RV, attending ski competitions. In the 1990s, they moved to Colorado, and St. Ange joined a rat pack of junior skiers. At 14, he made the U.S. national team and clinched his first World Cup win last year in Canada at 21.
When I landed, I knew that since my jump was so good that I was going to win. I just knew.
But he never could have imagined that he'd share the podium with his teammates.
We had a U.S. sweep that weekend, and that hadn't happened for a number of years before. That was the most special, most incredible way I could have possibly imagined winning for the first time.
St. Ange is a team player in this highly individualized sport. He's always supporting his fellow skiers, so they banded together following his World Cup win to give him a lift.
All my female teammates came up and picked me up and carried me up to the podium, and they all thought I should have eaten less the night before.
He also proved a heavyweight when he returned home to Steamboat Springs, Colorado for the U.S. Olympic trials last month, broadcast on NBC.
Three backflips, four full twist, and he nails the landing. Ryan St. Ange has laid down the gauntlet and stands up and works this crowd. He wants that ticket to Torino.
One clean jump later, he booked it. U.S. Olympic mogul skier Travis Cabral, a childhood friend, says St. Ange's strong mental focus will serve him well in Torino.
I've seen him compete, and he seems to just zone out and just be in his own little world. And that's what you need, you know, to be a top-level athlete. That's what you need. And he's got it.
St. Ange is looking forward to participating in the games, whether or not he bags any medals in Torino.
The experience of it, I know, is going to be the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to have fun no matter what happens.
Ryan St. Ange won't hold back for the games. He's been working on a jump with five twists and three flips. Success could give him the perfect landing on the medal podium. Freestyle skiing begins today in Sosdu. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. Thanks for nothing, Kelvin. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to listen to stories past and present or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from ESPN reporter Scott Burnside. When I asked him if New Jersey's gambling ring investigation was nicknamed Operation Slapshot because it included the Hansen brothers as special investigators.
No, but it might well be called Operation Black Eye if Gary Bettman was going to name it.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.